Okay, so maybe let's start. So are there any questions from last time or any other time? Yes.
Well, I say like primary field transforms on the conformal transformation with the like the Jacobian, the determinant of the Jacobian rays on our end, the Lorentz matrix. Is that in general any conformal transformation that's connected identity?
All of them. All of them. Any.
Because shouldn't primary field be killed by special conformal transformation?
Yes.
So how does the, like, I don't see how it becomes zero if you have a conformal transformation.
It's not zero. Well, why should it be zero?
Oh, I thought it's killed by special.
At the origin. So the idea is that you use symmetries to put any point to the origin, you determine the transformation at the origin, and then you push them back anywhere, any other point. But the stemma that it kills the operator, the special conformal transformations annihilate the a primary operator is at the origin.
So it stays at read.
Sorry?
It stays at read.
Sorry, I don't.
It stays at origin.
It stays at read?
You feel that the defined origin stays at origin under this special.
Sorry, I'm not understanding it.
The field that you find at the origin.
The origin, okay.
It stays at the origin. There is no translation. If you act the special.
Yeah, yeah, it's a fixed point. So the point is that the origin is a fixed point of dilatations and Lorentz transformations. Sorry, yes. No, but what did you say? I think you said something that's not quite right.
So if we do special conformal transformation for the field defined region, then it is still defined region.
That's true of any transformation, right?
But if we take some translation,
I mean, K does not preserve the origin, right? Is that what you're trying to say? K.
But the primary field is. Will be vanished if you act with the operator K.
Yes. Well, a primary operator will vanish. Not a descendant, no. Oh. Anyway, you can check that if you take O as a primary operator, then you can check that derivative of O, well, by definition, is a descendant, right? I acted here by acting with P mu. Mm-hmm. This is not annihilated by K mu at the origin. Good. So, okay, so maybe we should. Yes. No, that's fine, yes.
Is there a sense in which there is a lowering of determining the flows to get to infinity, or is that?
We are already at the fixed point. We are. Yeah. There could be, but we're studying the theory intrinsically at the fixed point. The whole approach I'm taking is that you study the properties of the CFT by sitting at the fixed point, and even if you didn't know where it came from in some energy flow.
Yes.
I mean, the notion of primary and descendant doesn't really make sense along the energy flow, because along the energy flow, you don't have a scale symmetry. You have a scale, the scale of the energy transformation. So yeah, so the statement about primaries and descendants is a notion that exists only in CFTs. So it's at the end of the fixed point, or if you start it in the UB, and then you deform by a relevant operator, that notion is also well defined at the asymptopia of the energy flow. Okay, good. So in the last, I finished last lecture by inviting you to think about the following remarkable property of CFTs, which is the statement that the position dependence of 2 and 3 point functions is completely fixed in a conformal field theory, which is very surprising if you ever thought about this problem in a relativistic theory, which definitely is not fixed. Okay. So did you get an intuitive understanding of why it's fixed? That means no. Yes. Okay. Anyway, We will see now because I'm going to do the four-point function, and then we'll see that that's not true for four-point functions, and the logic is the same. So the kind of the thing you can do in your head without much effort is to convince yourself that the two and the three-point functions are completely fixed, the position dependence are completely fixed. The thing that requires a little bit more work is to determine the exact position dependence. Okay, but that essentially just follows from saying. By the way, here I'm talking about primary operators, okay? Because remember that I said that the correlation function of a descendant is completely fixed in terms of the primary, because if you know the correlation function of this fellow, and you know you want to know the correlator of an operator in the tower, in the descendant, you just have to take derivatives. But you know how to take derivatives of this, right? So it's completely fixed.
Yeah.
So the descendants, that's why we never write down explicitly the correlators of the descendants, because they're just in some sense conceptually trivially determined in terms of those of the primaries. So the primaries are the ones that have very simple correlation functions of this form. So now to determine the exact function, essentially you have to demand that the left-hand side and the right-hand side transform in the same way. So if you associate to O the two quantum numbers that we discussed, which is dimension, scaling dimension, and Lorentz transformations, then the right-hand side has to transform in exactly the same fashion, okay? And anyway, part of it you know from intuition. So you know, for example, that Lorentz Poincaré tells you that things have to depend in terms of differences, right? Of lengths, of the positions of the vectors. And the scale transformations will tell you that things have to scale in the right way. So remember that I said that under scale transformations, an operator transforms like this. Okay? So now you have to check, you have to write a function that has the right homogeneous behavior on the scale transformation on the left and on the right, and so on and so forth. More generally, let me say a small parenthesis. Generally, there's a more kind of systematic way you can do it for any symmetry. Essentially, what we're doing here is solving word identities. This is true for any symmetry. And essentially, the basic idea is that physically what you do is you look at the correlation functions of transformed operators, and the statement that the path integral has a symmetry, or the whatever, your system has a symmetry, is that correlation function is the same as the correlation functions of the untransformed operators evaluated at the same point, okay? Now, from here you can derive differential equations. Or you can study this directly. Actually, for the conformal transformations, actually, it's probably the easiest thing to do is just to study, because you know how O tilde transforms for a generic transformation and not necessarily infinitesimal. But for infinitesimal transformations, this expression is nothing but the sum over all operator insertions, let's call it I, of O x1, delta O xn, xi, O xn equals 0. So the statement that you have the correlation functions of your theory respect the symmetry is that if you do a variation of the correlation function and you act over all operators, so you have variation satisfies the Leibniz rule, right? So you have the variation of the whole enchilada is the sum of the variations of each term, and this has to vanish. This is exactly the same as saying that the correlator has the symmetry. But now you know what this, we know what delta O is, right? For a conformal transformation, it was minus this kind of nonsense plus Lorentz plus scale. So you can think of it, if you wish, as a differential equation that when you solve, you get this, okay? But this statement is true for any symmetry, space-time or non-space-time, it doesn't matter. Okay, good. So now let's discuss, okay, so now the point is that by just solving than of these kinematics, we have shown that the non-trivial information about the CFT so far, and we're going to call it CFT data, is the following, is the following numbers. So first you have the collection of these delta i's that appear all over the place, but in particular they're first defined by the two-point function of the primary operators, and these are the scaling dimensions of your CFT, of the primers of your CFT. And again, in critical phenomena, they describe critical exponents in either thermal or quantum phase transitions. And then the other important quantity that appears is this tensor, Cijk, that tells you how these three primaries talk to each other, okay? And these are called the structure constants. And, okay. And it is useful to think about this system. And actually, what we will see soon is actually that's all the data that the CFT has. It's not that the four-point function gives you more data that you need to discover. What the four-point function does, or the higher point functions do, is to actually give you constraints on the possible sets of data that the CFT can have. So the entire CFT data is just, we haven't shown this yet, but we will show it in a second. Well, not in a second, but in an hour or two. That the actual data of the CFT is just this set of numbers, okay? But the set of numbers right now, at this point, are completely arbitrary. I have not told you what are the possible constraints on them are, okay? So one of the things that we will see is that CFTs have important consistency conditions that will restrict the allowed values of delta and C. Yes?
Is that true in all dimensions, including two?
Which is true?
This is all of the data that there is, just the scaling dimensions and
space. Yes, yes, yes. And actually, in two dimensions, there are special miracles that happen that make things easier, not harder, because you have more symmetry. I mean, in two dimensions, you have a bit of sort of symmetry. And then the crossing equation that we will discuss at some point that will impose constraints on this data.
You are in the meeting now.
Okay. Yeah, the point is that actually in two dimensions, there's a special class of models that actually the higher point functions are completely determined by a differential equation. That's definitely not true in higher dimensions. That's something very special to two dimensions, what are called rational or minimal conformal field theories. So one thing that's useful to think about, one conceptual way to that I find it useful to think about is that you should think of these Cijks as the structure constants of a Lie algebra, okay? Now, you know that in a Lie algebra, you have a structure constants, but they have to satisfy constraints, right? So they, in particular, they have to satisfy the Jacobi identity, okay? So one of the things that we will see is that the four-point functions satisfy very nonlinear constraints on the structure constants and the delta I, okay? So that actually, generically, in some sense, some quite rigorous sense, if you pick at random a collection of deltas and Cs, there is no solution. So we're working towards that. So try to find a set of constraints, physical constraints, that will tell us what values of D essentially are D and C, delta and C are disallowed. Okay. Notice that this is very different from what happens in usual theories. And the reason it happens is that we have symmetries are good. They allow us to restrict the possible dynamics by a lot. Okay, okay. So now let's go to the four-point function, and now we will see. Yeah.
Is the delta I or two delta?
This should be two delta. Yeah.
And this is the form for scalars.
Yeah, for scalars. Yeah.
And is there anything like different that matters for non-scalar?
I mean, the details the details are important. Yeah.
But in terms of data?
No, because the here what you get is a tensor that has the same Lorentz properties as the operators on the left. And that tensor actually is always built of the tensor. Remember that I said you have an inversion, the inversion operator. Out of the inversion operator, you can define a tensor, which is the dx dx tilde. That's like the Jacobian, the transformation. That is a tensor. It turns out that for operators with higher spin, like spin one would be a current, spin two would be like, for example, for the energy momentum tensor, which is a very important correlation function, two-point function, and three-point function. All of these are determined in terms of the, by essentially putting together the Jacobian tensor of the inversion operator. Yes?
And the four-point function won't introduce any other structure
concept. No.
This is just for the
three-point. Yes, it will not introduce more structure concepts. Yeah. And the four-point function will put relations that sys have to obey. Yeah. So let's do four-point functions. So the first thing we want to see is whether, whether it's true that the position dependence is completely fixed or not. So let's start with four points, x1, x2. So these are, and we're in the dimensions, right? So these are d vectors, okay? Now, okay, so the thing I said last time and the thing that I had wanted you to think about a little bit, the statement that the position dependence here and here is completely fixed can be thought conceptually by the fact that if you take two or three arbitrary points in RD, in Minkowski space, by a series of conformal transformations, I can bring those two or three arbitrary points to canonically defined points. Let's call it 0, 1, and infinity, okay? So that essentially tells you that the position dependence is kind of trivial. That's not true. I mean, you cannot do that. So but another point, so the question will be, can we do the same with four points, okay? So actually, so along the way, we will actually prove that this is true, okay? So first, imagine I want to map a point, one of the points, say, at infinity. Which transformation can I use to map, say, x4 to infinity that always exists? Yes, and then, yeah, but the more precise way of saying it, you do a special conformal transformation. So k mu, yeah, so I mean, the way to think about it is that you have a x4, you translate it, you do an inversion, and then, yeah, but the critical component is that you use k mu. Okay? So this maps this. I'm still writing the same letters. But of course, these points were mapped to wherever they were mapped by that special conformal transformation that mapped x4 to infinity, right? Now, the next idea is that, okay, now what's a nice point to look at is, let's say, 0, okay? So now, is there a transformation that preserves, because I don't want to mess with this fellow anymore, right? I don't want it to move it from there. That say we'll map this operator, we'll keep this operator where it was and set, say, x1 to 0.
Translation.
A translation, yeah. Again, I'm cheating a little bit by not changing the names, but obviously these guys are translated, okay? So. So we're, you know, we're slowly going through all the generators. At some point, something will give. Okay, so now what do I want to do? Yeah, for example, one thing I can do is that, so again, now I want to look at transformations that preserve 0 and infinity, okay? Actually, the two left do that, right? Dilatations and rotations preserve 0 and infinity. But for now, what I want to do is to eliminate degrees of freedom. So x3 is a d vector, and I want it to have norm 1. What transformation can I do to fix the norm of x3? Sorry? Yeah, the identity. Sorry, what did I say? Sorry?
Scaling?
The relation. Yeah. Sorry. So I have 0, x2. Now, this is a unit vector. I don't know how to write this. Okay. Now, what do I want to do? Now, okay, so let me write it, and then let's see if we agree to this. So now I claim that there is a collection of transformations that will allow me to map this to So, is it agreeable that if I now do a Lorentz transformation or a rotation, it will preserve zero and infinity? And I can take any D vector, and by a collection of rotations, bring it to this canonical vector, OK? So now we can see which transformations we have to use. So can someone tell me actually which explicit Lorentz transformations I have to use to bring any canonical vector to this form?
Rotation.
Sorry?
Rotation.
But which ones? So let's call this 1 to D. Huh? Well, so let's do an Euclidean space for simplicity.
Project the elements of the x3 onto this vector and see the angles and then just rotate about all those angles.
Yes. But more precisely, what I'm doing, should we fix the dimensions so it's less obnoxious? Let's fix to be in 4 dimensions. Otherwise, I'm just worried that if I make it too general, it will be D's all floating all over the place. Let's try to do it in the dimension. No. What do you prefer, general D or 4 dimensions or 3? You choose the dimension.
So, I don't know, but if we do the inner product, we can get the angle, I suppose, and some sort of cross, if we rotate along the plane of them, what the angle of the inner product is.
Yeah, so I think what you want to say is that it will be M12, M13 up to M1D, right? Is that clear? That by rotating in each of these planes, I can remove that coordinate in from X2 to, okay. Good. So, okay, so this is what M's. And now you can say, well, in generic dimensions, I have not used all the m's yet, right? There are extra m's. So you could say, well, maybe I can use the other m's to, again, completely fix everything. So OK. So of course, now I have to use rotations that preserve these 3 points, right? But there's still rotations that do that, right? So the thing I want you to think about is that, so this is a general D vector. I want you to convince yourself that I can always rotate away D minus 2 coordinates. So let me call this, let me call it A, B, 0, 0, OK? And when you reach here, there is nothing else you can do. I mean. OK, can someone tell me, for example, which rotations I need to do to go from a generic D vector to this vector? Exactly, yeah. So I guess this should have been here, sorry. So now here, I have to do M23, M2D. Notice that these preserve these 3 vectors. Now, is there something else I can do? Not really, that's it. But one thing you can commit, so now you can think about the geometry. I don't want to do it in the blackboard, but finally, imagine you're in 3 dimensions. You will find that by the time you're done with this, you have exhausted all m's have been used. Let's count. Here there are, I'm going to mess it up, but OK, I'll try. So this is d minus 1, which is otherwise known as 2. And this, how many are there here? One more, 3. How many rotations do we have in 3 dimensions? In SO3, there are 3, right? So I used all of them. But for example, if I'm in 4 space-time dimensions, I have here 3. And I have here 2, that's 5. How many rotations are there in? There's one left, but which one is left over that I haven't used? Is M34. right? But M34 does not help us anymore, because M34 does not move this. It preserves all the 4 points, right? So I cannot remove degrees of freedom. So one left over. So the general result is that in any dimensions, even there may or may not be residual m's left, but at most, and at most or at least, yeah, you cannot get any less than two cross ratio. Okay, the less than two coordinates. So there exist a two. Essentially, what you could say is that the 4-point functions depend on two coordinates. You could call them x1 and x2. Sorry, A and B, which are just the two components of, say, the one operator. Okay. Good. So now, using this logic, you could continue to 5-point functions, 6-point functions, and so on. So can someone guess what the what the number of coordinates that the endpoint function will depend on? So we did 4, now in general, endpoint function. Can someone guess? At some point, you'll run out of dollars, right? So then, but how many coordinates do you start with? Sorry?
N.
N times D.
Oh, we're counting the.
Yeah, yeah. We're counting parameters, yeah. So we have N times D. I keep changing the, okay, I'll use capital D.
I suppose you can get rid of the same, only of the same amount of coordinates that we got rid of here.
No, you can get more. For example, if I go to the 5-point function, I can use the Lorentz boost to get rid of. So here I said that there was one Lorentz boost, Lorentz rotation left. I can use it to save some money. So at the end of the day, you cannot remove more than the dimension of the conformal algebra, right? So that from here you're going to get, so that remember that it was SO2, D. So this is going to be d plus 1 divided by 2. And that's it. And this usually happens pretty early on in the game. So you, by the 5-point function, you kind of used everything. In 4 dimensions, if you go to higher dimensions, funny things will happen. But there's always exist an n for which you will saturate, obviously, all the possible conformal transformations. Good. So now, okay, so we discovered that in 4-point functions depend on 2 arbitrary coordinates. Unlike in 2 dimensions where, in the first 3 steps, we essentially proved as a lemma what I said there, right? That everything was fixed. Okay, so the more invariant way of saying this is that you can define cross ratios. So I'm gonna say what these 2 coordinates are by writing conformal invariant ratios of the 4 points, right? We have points x1 up to x4. I'm gonna write something that's conformal invariant and that depends on these 4 points. They're called cross ratios or conformal ratios. So I define U. So these are things, combinations of coordinates that are Poincaré invariant, dilatation invariant, and a special conformal invariant. So that's U, usually call them U and V. And V is obtained from U essentially by exchanging 1 and 3. You have 4 points, and I can define another independent coordinate by exchanging 1 and 3. So that's going to give me 1, 4 square. 1, 3 square, no, 1 and 3, so that's 2, 3 square, 1, 3 square, x, 2, 4 square. So it should be obvious that these guys are invariant under all of them. Maybe it's not obvious that they're invariant under K. So what you can convince yourself is that the easiest way to prove that they're invariant under K is to see how they transform under inversions. Will transform very simply under inversions. They're obviously going to be invariant under translations and then invert back, and then you'll see that precisely this ratio is invariant under that. Yes?
When n and d are both 4, this would give 1 coordinate?
Sorry?
When n and d are both equal to 4, this would give 1 coordinate, not 2.
What would give 1 coordinate? No, but that's what I'm saying. So this is when n is large enough. This is when you have exhausted.
Oh.
If you are not exhausted all of them, this is subtracting too much. But if you go to 5, I believe you get the right answer already. Yes?
One question. So just to clarify, the logic from before, OK. To make an analogy with Poincaré, in Poincaré, we say we have rotations and translations. And out of that, we say our two-point correlation functions depend only on the distance between the points. That is, there's only one number. It's an arbitrary function of only one number. That's what I was saying.
Yeah.
And in conformal, it's not even an arbitrary function. It's that one specifically because of scaling.
Yes.
So here we say we have 4 points. So
it's going to be a function of U and B.
Of U, exactly. Of those two numbers, A and B that we found. It's going to be an arbitrary function of those.
Yes.
But now we're saying this is for higher point functions. We're saying, OK, let's study more generally quantities that are invariant under conformal transformations.
Yes.
What are we saying here now?
OK, forget about higher point functions. OK, I just made this comment about higher point functions. The point is that actually in CFTs, higher point functions don't buy you much. The constraints that higher point functions give are not new constraints that the four functions already give you. But this was just for you to do a mental exercise of that you understood how we were using the conformal symmetries to remove degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
Here, all I'm saying is I'm going to say the same thing I said here in a more covariant language. I'm saying that if I give you 4 points, I can construct these clever ratios that are invariant under conformal transformations. If I give you 2 or 3 points, there is nothing you can write down that's invariant under conformal transformations.
So these will be the two numbers, like.
Sorry?
These will be the
two. This will turn A and B. If I take now x4 to infinity, blah, 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 those are A and B, yeah. Yes.
These cross ratio are always positive, so like they are invariant under reflection also? Like.
Yes. Are you saying that
can you make something more general, but with like minus signs? Like, I understand why the twos have to be there because of the other conformal transformations,
yes.
But shouldn't there be like
Which signs?
Like if it, instead of depending on x1, 2 squared, it depends just in x1, 2, it would be different if like.
But no, but it has to be magnitude of x1, 2, right? Otherwise it's not Lorentz invariant. Lorentz invariant is about the length. Okay. Good. So, okay, so.
I don't understand what up on that. Is it counting the number of independent cross ratios?
Yes, it's counting, actually, what it's counting now that it is introduced cross ratios, is counting the number. Okay, again, for n sufficiently large, there are, as I said before, like if n is too small, I'm speaking in some weird language, okay, so this formula subtracts too much, so then this is overcounting or whatever. Yes, it's undercounting. What this is telling you is the number of cross ratios that exist for n points. So you can try to write them down. Try to write down the analog of this for higher n.
Then why is it not working for n plus 4?
Because as I said here, I had not used M34. If I act with M34 on these 4 points, it doesn't allow me to remove anything else, right? Because if I act on M34 here.
I see. So it's over. Okay.
Yeah. Good. No, I'm saying, I mean, you cannot use more constraints than symmetries you have. You have already used up all the, so here, you know, I used everything. There is nothing else you can use. There will be, I'm talking about kinematics. There are going to be dynamical constraints. But in terms of kinematics, I have, this is the max, this is the number of symmetries I have. I cannot remove more parameters than the number of symmetries. look at the counting here, right? I remove d in the first step, d in the second step, 1 in the second step, whatever. D minus 1 in the third step.
So the higher point functions, we're saying they don't contribute new constraints and they don't contribute new information.
Yeah, I haven't shown that, but yes. But you are welcome to study the five-point function, but then the five-point function will be a function of not just two cross ratios. Of actually, I think that now this depends on the dimension. I think in four dimensions, it's three cross ratios. Okay, so that means that the most general form function of, not for simplicity, because if I try to make it too general, it's not feasible. So let's consider the four-point function of identical scalar operators. Okay, and let's call the operator phi. So we have phi of x1, phi of x2, phi of x3, phi of x4. So this guy, something, I have to write down something that has the right dimension. But now, unlike the case of lower point functions, here I can write an arbitrary function g of uv. That's completely unfixed. I know nothing about it. This is like the analog of inducial Poincaré, that you don't know anything about the function that constrains, say, three-point functions. Okay, so it looks like we are stuck, but what we will see is the following thing. So that we'll see that GUV is not an independent function. Actually, what we will see is that GUV can be written in a complicated but explicit way in terms of this, of the data, of deltas and the c's, okay? And it's determined by delta I cijk, okay? And we will see that, well, this is what I said before, that this correlator constrains delta I cijk, which at this point are just arbitrary data that you could thought could have been anything. Good. So now I have to, okay. Is there any questions? Oh, moving so slow. Yes.
When we talk about the data of scaling dimensions and the 3-point structure constants, what does it mean from the perspective of the mathematical structure of operators to specify that data? Like, if we have two different sets of data, two different conformal field theories. Two different sets of data.
Yes.
Scaling dimensions and structure constants for two different theories.
Yes.
Does that correspond to having two different collections of operators that we're considering?
They are two different CFTs.
But they're different in the sense that they have different operator content?
Different operator content, different dimensions, scaling dimensions, different everything. Yeah. For example, the Ising CFT has a collection of deltas and C's. So there's something called the tricritical Ising CFT, which is a higher order critical point. It's also CFT, but it has different sets of deltas and C's. So kind of delta and C is kind of the DNA of the CFT, essentially. It tells you what the CFT is. Yeah, as I said, this is not it's not simple, because above two dimensions, one of the things you can, yeah, the number of deltas, the number of primary operators is necessarily infinite. So it's a, yeah. But what we will see is that, I mean, one of the things that was done in recent years, I mean, the last 10, whatever, 15 years, is to use this to put useful constraints on these gadgets by doing some kind of consistent truncation. So we're going to see that there's a certain nonlinear functional equation that G has to satisfy. And I will show now that G is related in terms of delta and C in a particular way. You can use that numerically to try to bound what are the possible admissible values of delta and C. And by doing that, for example, I mean, by playing this game, this is by far the most precise computation of the critical exponent of the 3D Ising model is done using this method. So people do it using Monte Carlo, whatever, many other ways. But this way, you don't care where the theory comes from. You just solve numerically this constraint that we're going to discuss, and you get incredible precision about what the critical exponents are, and also the three-prime functions. OK. So now I have to introduce an important idea, which is the idea of the operator product expansion. Usually, this is the acronym OP, yes.
Just the two comments. I'm reading it right now. The correlation function, which is given by G, is determined by the data, but then the correlation function determines the data.
Because what we'll see is there is more than one way. There are two different looking ways of computing the four-prime function, and then you get a constraint. Okay. And we have to solve that constraint. It's a nonlinear constraint. Okay, so what's the idea of the OPE?
Can I ask one more question?
Yes.
So in this scheme of decomposing larger endpoint correlation functions down into three and then solving for everything, I'm just wondering, are all the observables that we care about in a CFT of the form finite number of endpoint correlation functions?
No. I mean, one of the things that we learned in the last few years is that in CFTs, there is more, I mean, even in general, not CFTs. In quantum field theories, there is much more to field theories than local operators. Right now, we just only discuss local operators, right? But in field theories, we have operators that instead of being supported at points, they're supported on curves or on surfaces. And what we've done here so far doesn't say anything about them. Actually, this could be a good exercise. You could ask, imagine I give you an operator that's supported on a circle. Then you could ask, what is the most general, say, two-point function of a line operator that's supported on a circle and a local operator that sits here? Okay, you can ask, what is the most general position dependent? And then you can use conformal symmetry to fix that. But in these lectures, unfortunately, we are only discussing local operators. But there is much more to life than local operators.
So when we say we're solving the CFT, we mean we're solving for the
local
functions
of local operators. Yes. And you can have line operator. You can study also boundary conditions. So you can study the theory instead of in the plane. RD in half space, right? And then you have x. Say let's say xd equals zero. You have a boundary. Let's say this is an RD minus one boundary. You could ask, and that's something that is very important in many aspects in life. You can ask about the possible conformally invariant boundary conditions that you can impose here. And this introduces new data. And you can study that. But the same philosophy that I'm giving you for local operators, verbatim, you could use for boundaries, line operators, surface operators, and so on. Yeah, one thing I forgot. Yeah. Do you know what happens under conformal transformations to a circle?
Maps another circle?
Yeah. Lines and circles get maps to, I say lines with points at infinity are maps to lines, which are circles. Okay. So imagine we want to study a correlation function like this. And I'm not committing to what other operators I have inserted in ... okay? Because I'm going to make a local statement. The basic idea of the operator product expansion is that you have two operators, OI, OJ. And then essentially what I'm doing is I'm replacing, and what I do is I draw a circle around them. And I do an analog of what would be a multiple expansion that you've seen in electromagnetism, right? So roughly speaking, the intuition is that you have two operators that are close to each other. But from far away, you're going to distinguish this from one giant local operator, right? So the idea of the OPE is that you can replace these fellows by the sum of essentially an effective local operator, but I have to sum over all operators. So k, this index k here, is a sum over all primaries and descendants. Because from far away, I cannot distinguish that these points are too close from one effective local operator. The price that we pay is that in order for this statement to be true, we have to sum over all possible operators, okay? So that's a nasty sum, and you need to figure out actually what the coefficients of those operators are that you don't know a priori. But conformal symmetry is gonna tell us what it is. Why is it? Yeah, what it's not that it's redundant. I mean, the word is not that it's redundant. You have to sum over them, but then we'll be clever, and the effect of summing over the descendants will kind of bootstrap to the effect of the primary in the family. But we have to sum over everything. It's like when you do the compose. Sorry, SU2 spin. You have to sum over all azimuthal angles, but essentially everything is determined in terms of the highest weight. Okay. So let me write some formulas now. Yeah, so this part is a bit formula intensive, so maybe focus more on the concepts than the formulas, but let's see. So in equations, what I'm doing is this. So this x2, x1, x2. Okay, and now I'll use the fact, which is the comment I just made, that in a sense, the effect of the descendants I can encode just by derivatives, right? Because the descendants are just derivatives. So now, okay, so maybe, so here I'm gonna use the index f I j k tilde. So, but here the index k is a sum over primary and descendants. Here the sum is only over primaries. I don't know, it's f I j k, which is been a function of the difference, of the distance between 1 and 2. And then the contribution of the descendants are just derivatives with respect to the argument x2 of all k x2. So essentially, I drew a ball around these two points, and I have replaced this ball by an effective local operator, which actually is an infinite sum. We'll discuss later the caveats of this expansion. But there are no caveats, but yeah, we'll have to discuss what we know. Okay, and now what I'll discuss is that now we can determine, actually I'll tell you how to determine this guy completely, at least conceptually. So the way we're going to do it is that we start with the three-point function. So because right now this is a function that we know nothing about. Actually, we know, well, conformal symmetry completely fixes. Okay, what I'm gonna tell you is that conformal symmetry completely fixes what this function is. And one way to derive it is to start with a three-point function. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to do the OPE of these two first operators. We know this guy, right? We wrote the answer here. Okay, luckily didn't erase it. So it's a very explicit formula, okay? But now I choose to compute it by doing the OPE in x1 and x2. Actually, this is an expansion in x1, 2 divided by x2, 3. Okay? So now this is sum over k prime, Fij k prime, x1, 2, dk acting on 2. So now I've reduced this to the two-point function. Do you see what I did here? I essentially applied the OPE to the 3' function to reduce it to a 2' function, okay? But now I know what this is, right? This is delta k, k prime over x to 3 to the 2 delta k. I'm just using these equations, right? So now what I have to do is, I on the one hand, I have this expression that expand for a small x12, and I compare term by term with this expression that I have here, okay? Good. So the thing that's important here is that this guy is proportional to Cijk, right? So what you're going to get is the following. So that f, okay, so here I have delta, delta k prime. So essentially what I get here is Fijk is a function of x12 delta k2 of acting on x23, sorry, 2 delta k. So now by comparing this side with this side, what you find is that Fij is exactly the structural constant, 1 plus. And actually, what you should write is the most general thing that's consistent with a scale and conformal symmetry. So what can you write? You can write things that are Lorentz scalars and have dimension 0. So have alpha plus beta, x mu, x nu, d mu, x nu, plus dot, 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 with some coefficients alpha and beta that we're going to determine by comparing this guy with this guy, okay? Oh, I thought I wrote, yeah, okay, I don't have it written down here, but by doing the exercise, you can compute exactly what these numbers, alpha, beta, etc., okay? The crucial point of this is that in a conformal field theory, the OPE coefficients here are completely determined by conformal symmetry. It might be a nasty object, but conceptually, there is no new data there. It's written in terms of these alpha, betas, and so on will be written in terms of deltas, essentially, and geometric numbers like the dimension of space-time, things like that. Okay. Yes?
Why do we have a partial of k in the argument of f?
Yes, because this is how you resum the contribution of the descendants. The descendant, what is the contribution of the descendant? Is a descendant is just a derivative of the operator, right? So I'm just encoding the contribution of the infinite number of descendants with one derivative, two derivatives, three derivatives, by just differentiating. So, I mean, that's what I'm doing here in more concrete terms. This is the first descendant, this is the second descendant, so on and so forth.
But the derivative is always with respect to x2.
Yes.
Yes. First
line,
partial 2. Like partial 2.
That's what I mean by, that's what I mean by partial 2 means with respect to x2. Yeah.
And then the k means act with k times?
Sorry?
And the k means it's k product of derivative operator.
What does k mean? I think k shouldn't be there. Oof, I don't know if I have time. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, no.
I have two questions.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. No, maybe it's better that let's just have questions and then I'll kind of, because what comes next is a bit of a long sausage, so I don't want to rush it, yeah.
So the first one is, in what sense is the product of those two operators given by that, by, like, what I'm trying to say is we're defining a new operator that is the product of those two operators on the left.
Yes.
And we're saying that is equal to the sum, but we mean it in the sense of correlation functions.
This statement is true. Okay, this statement is, that's why I wrote it this way. This statement is true inside any correlation function with one caveat. This expansion is valid, has a finite radius of convergence, but actually, it has a finite radius of convergence. That's already something remarkable, right? And the radius of convergence is up to the next point. So you have 1, 2, and 3. Sorry. Oh, I told the joke. Okay. So it's inside it's valid. If you can draw a sphere and there is no other operator inside it, and it blows up the, when you hit the next operator. But you can always, by doing conformal transformations, you can always draw a sphere around 2 points and then do it in steps. So that's the only caveat. It's an exact asymptotic, it's an exact convergent expansion.
And how do we understand the dependence of the Fij case on the derivative with respect to x2 only?
No, because I'm essentially the, this is the formula, right? So because I'm essentially replacing. You could have chosen, this is a particular, is a choice I'm making. You could have made a different choice and the two would be related by symmetry. What I'm saying is I'm replacing this, I have two operators and I'm replacing it by an operator at one of the, at the location of one of the other operators. I could have chosen the midpoint, but then formulas look messy. It's easier to just OPE and expand around the location of one of the operators. But you could, there would be absolutely nothing wrong if you did say a midpoint or whatever, but the formula will be more complicated, but then you would have to conjugate whatever I say by translations and so on. But conceptually, it's just you're replacing the sum, sorry, the 2 points by 1 point, and you have some freedom. Actually, you can put it anywhere in this sphere, but let's be clever and put it in the location of one of them. Yeah.
Now just comparing this with the previous three-point function, why were we there labeling the deltas with 1, 2, 3?
Sorry? Oh, sorry?
In the three-point function you go down here, the deltas are labeled with one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm probably not, was not terribly consistent.
Oh, okay.
You could have written ijk. So the operator is either, so here, yeah, it's labeled by the label and the point, yeah. If you prefer ijk, you're totally welcome, yeah. Yeah, I should have, yeah.
I have a couple of confusions. One is when we're writing the proper function here, why are we choosing x1,
2, x3, 4? That's a choice. You could choose a different, you can make a different choice, then you would get a different function g prime. Any other choice you make can be absorbed by a power of u and b. Yes. Yeah, yeah, so it's just a choice of coordinates. There is no, yeah. You can try to parameterize it in something that will have for that scale with 4 phis, and you will see that I can write it in terms of this by multiplying or dividing u's and b's. Yeah.
I was also confused about, maybe I'm missing things in my head, but is there some sense in which OPE is a measure of entanglement, or like show something about entanglement of the theory, or is it
entanglement? Not in a very direct way, no. I mean, entanglement is a statement about states. Here, it's really a very local statement. We're not saying whether this happens in a thermal state, in the vacuum state, in a state that created with 75 local operators or no. Not in any direct way, yeah.
Did you say that you get the form of the Fijk by comparing with the original?
Yeah, by doing the expansion for a small x12.
But doesn't the original three-point function also depend on x13? Like there is a factor, there's x. One, three, like you don't have any
no, but I'm expanding x1 is, so what, x1 is x2 minus x12, something like that. That's what I'm doing. I'm doing an expansion. Yes, yes, yes.
And here x means basically x12 and partial.
Yes, I'm not writing, yes, yes, yes. You should really put twos everywhere, but it would sound a bit too much, yeah.
When I have seen LPEs, one thing that I was wondering is why they're always introduced in CFTs and not in other theories, even though the concept still exists.
They're introduced in other theories too.
So I see now that it seems like the importance is that the symmetries constrain so much the OPE coefficients that we can actually make some use of the concept. Is that why OPEs seem to be so important?
Yes, if you have a mass scale, you could have more general things here. Also, if the theory is not a CFT, I think in general it's unknown whether the OPE is a convergent expansion. But it's a good expansion. For example, in QCD, is a good expansion at very short distances. Actually, this has been used very importantly to study quantum chromodynamics at very short distances. But in general, the symmetries don't, you don't have conformal symmetry, so you cannot fix the structure constants. And second, there are issues about the convergence of the series. Yes?
In the function fijk, is there a divergence that is a function of x mod?
Divergence? No, this is fijk, there is no divergence.
What I'm trying to ask is, naively it seems like the correlation function between O1, O of x1 and O of x2 should have, as they get closer to each other, there should be a 1 over x squared divergence.
Yes, but as long as, yes?
What I'm trying to say is, ask is the series getting rid of that divergence, or do we still have it in the function fijk?
This is the function f, there is no divergence anywhere. Yeah. I mean, one thing that's very important to say about actually general field theories and conformal theories in general, that correlation functions of local operators at coincident points are usually not very well defined and depend on choices that you make in the UV. So, okay, so I'm gonna say it, but so, you know, usually in field theory, you may have ultraviolet divergences, right? So you have to add, you have to regularize the theory by adding local counterterms. I'm saying buzzwords that you, but I'm sure you know this. Okay, so the statement is that different choices of local counterterms, which are different choices of renormalization schemes, should not affect physical things. So it should not affect separated point correlation functions, but may change the value of the correlation functions at coincident points. So coincident point correlation functions generically, you should not be looking at, because they are polluted by choices that dirty humans made. So,
but if I look at the correlation function on the left-hand side,
sorry,
I simply look at the left-hand side of that.
Yeah, here.
The three-point correlation function, yeah. And if I take the limit as, let's say, x1 goes to x2.
Yeah, I'm doing it. But I'm saying that don't put them put them arbitrarily close, but not on top of each other, okay. And then it's fine.
So this formula is valid.
Okay. Yeah. Along, it's called along the diagonals. Along the diagonals, you have delta functions. You have some distribution. You can talk about distributions, right? Because you have some nasty thing. You have delta functions, derivative of delta functions, but these are not really terribly meaningful things, because different people will compute it in different ways and get different answers. And it's not a continuum observable.
You said this is a dimensioning x1 to over x2, 3, but here we only have some limited power of x2, 3 in our experiment, like, which is x2, 3 to the power.
By this, I meant that I was trying to convey this idea that I wrote here. Just try to do the exercise that this expansion converts up to the location to this point. That's what I was trying to say. Just try to do it, you will see that things will organize in this fashion. I mean, this expansion has a finite radius of convergence, and the radius of convergence is x to 3, essentially.
And that factor will appear in, like...
No, this... appear where, sorry. No, the f is a function of x1, 2 only.
Yeah, but that's what I asked, that's what I was asking, because where would that factor appear in our expansion? If we wanted to.
Well, I have x23 here too, right? So I have x23 is on the left and on the right. But I have x. No, but I'm taking derivatives, right?
Okay.
All right. So I think next time, I didn't want to rush through this. Hopefully, try to think about this exercise. I mean, it's for actually, I don't know if this is in one of the tutorials, but you can try to compute what alpha and beta is. And then the idea that I want to convey in the next lecture is that we can use this idea of the OPE in the four-point function by computing the four-point function in what we call in two different channels, either by doing this OPE or by doing this OPE. What we'll show is that these OPEs are two different expansions of the same observable, but they both have a common radius of convergence, okay? So these two functions, at least in that domain, have to agree. And this will give us these constraints on G. And in particular, since G will be related to Fs, which is constrained to be, which is fixed by Cs and deltas, that's how we're going to get constraints on Cs and deltas. By using essentially that convergence of the OPE in two different channels, and that the fact that the OPE coefficients are determined in terms of Cs and deltas. But yeah.
I have a trivial question. Like, how do we know that the two-point function depends on x2, 3 to the power 2 delta k?
That's the conformal word identities. That's what we derived there. Well, derived. That's what I discussed here, right?
Can I see it in terms of propagators? Because
propagators is a. I mean, okay, go on.
Like, I usually think of two-point function as propagator from x1 to x2.
Because you're thinking of Feynman diagrams. These are not fields in a Lagrangian. But yeah, but go on. Maybe we'll get somewhere. Yes.
So in that case, I would think of having a p squared in the denominator. But
yeah, and if you Fourier transform, what do you get?
Derivative of x squared.
We get x squared to the right power, right? Yeah. In a, if the theory is massless, if the field is massless.
But it seems non-trivial that the scaling coefficient of the field delta I is also the coefficient which is also the index.
Are you saying why? Actually, one thing I didn't say here. Let me see what you're saying. Are you saying why the two-point function?
Why is x12 raised to the power 2 delta I, where delta I is precisely the scaling coefficient of the operator
theta? Well, that's the discussion I said about the conformal word identity. But the way to see it is, you know how O transforms under dilatations, right? It transforms with lambda 2 minus delta. Well, the function that you have here has to transform with the same way as the left hand side. So x has to appear with the same deltas.
And it's there in the notes.
Yes. I mean, if this was, I don't know what other number you would want here, but whatever you write here has to be consistent with the left and the right should transform exactly the same way under all of them. But for dilatation, it's very simple. You just rescale lambdas to some power. So it's clear that here you're going to get lambda to delta I plus delta j. Here you have to get lambda of delta I plus delta j. The thing that's not obvious, actually, special conformal transformations disallow, tells you that the two-point function of OI on OJ is necessarily zero if delta I is different than delta J. That's what I'm trying to say here. Yeah. And that just follows from this. Actually, part of it follows from this, and the last statement I made comes from looking at what happens under special conformal transformations. And also, if you count here, you could count. Let's see if I do a scale transformation. If I make a scale transformation, it should transform under lambda to delta 1, delta 2, delta 1 plus delta 2 plus delta 3, right? So if I didn't make a mess, let's count here. So how many 1s I get here? I get 1, like 1 minus 1 plus 1 is 1, and the same with 2 and the same with 3. Yes?
Is there a way to think about why the OP sum converges in that particular radius?
There is a way to think about it. The most physical way, but discussing this is not the time now, is essentially through the operator state correspondence. In quantum mechanics, you're familiar with the fact that you did it without thinking. That, you know, when you have the unit operator or whatever, you decompose it into an infinite sum of the eigenstates, right? It's essentially that. I mean, why does that make any sense? Actually, you should ask that first. So if you understand that, then this statement is true in CFT because of the operator state correspondence. It's exactly the same statement, that you can replace the identity by the sum over all eigenstates. All right, so I see you Wednesday, I think.